Blog Talk Radio.
Movie Geeks United, a special documentary version of Movie Geeks. We have three interviews tonight, all with terrific documentary filmmakers, and they've got terrific new films out. My name is Jamie, and I'm joined here, as usual, by Jerry. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How is everyone tonight?
It's a good night. It's a good night. Very relaxed night.
Yes, it is.
Just got up from a nap, feeling good.
Refresh. No, I think our listening audience definitely appreciates that detailed description as well.
Yeah, you don't want a groggy Jamie.
We don't want a groggy Jamie. Yeah.
I get very testy when I'm sleepy. So how have things been with you, man, since Sunday? You see anything interesting?
No, I've just been really, like, chilling, you know. Nothing really worthwhile going out in the theater to see, just chilling, taking stuff at home, work, that sort of thing. How about you?
I have a stack of movies.
I have the Netflix movies and
I get mailed movies and I have a stack of them. And there's a title that I can't wait to watch, and I know you feel the same way.
Oh yeah, I can't wait. And, we should thank James right now.
Yeah, absolutely, he's in our chat room. We're going to. I don't know if you want us to reveal that we have it or not, but I guess the cat's out of the bag. He can tell us not if he doesn't want us to reveal it on the chat room. But he mailed us something that he made that we've talked about on the show before. And we cannot wait to watch it. And I've reserved all day Saturday because it seems like an all-day thing. I've reserved my weekend all day Saturday so I can give it my undivided attention because I'm so geeky about this movie.
Yeah, I want to watch it Saturday night. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, it's going to be so much fun. Okay. So I'm not seeing him right in the chat room. So, Garney, hello, Garney. Garney,
hi, Garney.
Look at this. Yeah, people are starting to come alive in the chat room tonight. Welcome. If you have any questions for any of our guests or for us, you can call us at 718-508-9477, or you can submit questions through the chat room. James says, we can't wait to hear what we have to say about Cloverfield. Later on the show, Aaron will be joining us, our DVD home entertainment correspondent. And he will go over Cloverfield, and I will go over the BBC Natural History Collection on DVD.
That's quite a compare and contrast, right there.
No, it is an astonishing box set, and it includes Planet Earth. You know, if you
right,
if you
yeah,
that.
No, that's great. Awesome.
Highly acclaimed, and I always wanted to talk to some of those filmmakers on the show. The filmmakers that film wildlife like that and marine life, and
mm-hmm.
It has to be such a kind of meticulous craft, very patient you have to be, I would think.
Oh yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah. But amazing stuff, amazing.
Goes back to the show on PBS, I don't know if it's still on, but we used to watch on Sunday nights Nature, it seemed like that was on every Sunday on PBS, we used to watch that all the time, so.
Yeah, but
with
the cameras and the new technology and stuff, I mean, nothing is out of sight, you know, nothing
yeah,
is out
absolutely.
Of balance.
Yeah,
absolutely. Capture anything. So we're excited to talk about that, and then we have three great documentary filmmakers, and one is a pre-recorded interview that we're going to start off the show with tonight. Fascinating guy, and a great film. Anyone who's a movie geek out there like we are going to eat this film up. Are we ready to play that? You want to go ahead and start with that?
Yeah, let's get it going.
Okay. This was an interview conducted just the other day. It has all the information you need right in the file. So here it goes. The history of the film movement in San Francisco is as old as the medium itself. Thus begins the exploration of Fog City Mavericks, the filmmakers of San Francisco. Director Gary Leva's insightful and endlessly entertaining new documentary about one of the most thriving artistic communities in the U.S., featuring interviews with giants like George Lucas, Francis Coppola, Sal Zintz, John Lasseter, and Chris Columbus, the film paints a vivid portrait of a filmmaking haven where independence and free artistic expression reign. Mr. Leva has previously produced and directed a series of behind-the-scenes documentary for several high-profile DVD releases, including the recent anniversary edition of All the President's Men, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Malcolm X, and numerous titles exploring the works of Stanley Kubrick. It is a great pleasure to welcome award-winning filmmaker Gary Leva to Movie Geeks United. Mr. Leva, hello.
Thank you. Well, hello to you.
It's great to have you on. I appreciate you you calling in tonight to be with us. I loved Fog City Mavericks. It is right up my alley. I was crazy about it, and I can't wait to discuss it with you. But first of all, tell me how you got into filmmaking, how you made your way into the industry yourself.
Well, I went to film school in Southern California, UCLA, and I worked in L.A. and in New York. I have a theater background prior to getting into film school, so I kind of bounced around between theater and film. And I got into documentaries by being an editor. I had the opportunity, one of my early jobs, actually, as an editor, was cutting a little five-minute tribute reel for George Lucas for an award he was getting. Ooh. This is the point where I was a freelance editor. And that really opened the doors in a lot of areas, but more than anything, creatively, because I had the unique experience of being an editor on this short documentary piece. And normally when you do something like this, you would be working with marketing executives or people like that. And I was just lucky because at the point that I was working on it, I started out working in L.A. I'm trying to make this short. It's probably not very short. I started out working in L.A., and I ended up working for Lucasfilm up at Skywalker Ranch for this little five-minute piece. And I was very lucky because during that period of time, the marketing executive who normally oversaw this sort of thing was on a sabbatical. And so the person sitting next to me at the Avid was George. So I actually got the chance
wow.
to be to work directly with him. And it isn't as if he taught me how to edit or went out of his way to be an educator, but I went out of my way to try to glean as much as I could from his insights, and it certainly changed the way I looked at filmmaking. And that experience really kind of put the hook in me in terms of making documentaries, because prior to that I hadn't spent a lot of time in the documentary world, and that sort of launched my my interest in it. And then over the years I worked with a lot of San Francisco people,
yeah,
including some of the people you mentioned, Francis Coppola and Sal Zintz and those guys.
Yeah, giants. And I can't imagine, you know, to be starting out in the industry and be sitting next to George Lucas right out of the gate. First of all, how wonderful that must have been, and plus how nerve-wracking to have him, you know, sitting right beside you as you're editing his piece.
Yeah, well, the lucky thing for me is that George is really an editor at heart, and I think if you talk to people who've worked with him over the years, they will tell you he's happiest in the editing room. So I was lucky enough to work with him in a realm that he's entirely comfortable in and where he's happy.
Yeah.
And he's
yeah.
very happy in the editing room. And he and I just kind of clicked in terms of that. I was very lucky that I had the opportunity to really do the one-on-one kind of thing, and it really turned everything around for me.
So you started producing these documentaries for the DVD extras.
Yes, the first one I did actually was Star Wars Episode I.
Wow.
That was the first producing I did for DVDs, and then I returned to Los Angeles, and I've been fortunate enough to work on a lot of really important films over the years, and I guess our reputation, my company is called Leva Filmworks, and I think our reputation is that we do fairly serious kind of work that's kind of akin to what you would see at film school. In fact, when I make these documentaries, my intention is to give the everyday, you know, viewer sort of at least a 30-minute experience of what it's like to be in a good film school. We don't just talk about, you know, how pretty the actresses are or
sure.
how much it
yeah.
rained that day on the set. We really try to go into what makes cinema work, why a film affects you the way it does. And that kind of thing has been really the focus of most of our work.
That's why I really respect the work you do so much in this field, because you can tell the thing that makes you distinctive just by the titles you work on. I mean, these are classic, serious masterpieces, a lot of them.
Yeah.
I think the last thing you tackled was the Kubrick set, the brand new Kubrick set that came out. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, no, I've tackled things since, but nothing I can talk about because it hasn't been released yet. But that's
okay.
The last big package that's actually on video store shelves.
That must have been fascinating. What kind of jewels did you find in your research of the man and his movies that you found most surprising?
The thing about Kubrick is that I wasn't a huge Kubrick fan. I loved Strangelove. I loved several of the films,
right.
But I wasn't a huge fan, and I just appreciated his stature, and I was interested in learning more about it, which I think is probably the best attitude you can have as a documentarian of any sort, is to be interested, is to be curious, to learn more, because your process of learning more is what results in the film having that sort of sense of discovery. The thing that really amazed me just on a personal level was that the more I watched the films, and when you're making a documentary about, for instance, A Clockwork Orange, you're going to end up knowing A Clockwork Orange better than 99% of the people on the planet. You really are going to know every frame of the film if you're doing the kind of work we do. And the more I watched his films, not just Clockwork, but others as well, the more I liked them, the more they held up to scrutiny. So that a film like The Shining, which initially was not my favorite of his films, I mean, now I think of it as a virtual masterpiece. So his ability to put out something that has layers of meaning that you only really discover after repeated viewings is the thing that surprised me the most creatively.
Yeah, and that's why they'll survive. And
absolutely.
I was just thinking about this the other day. You know, we're coming up on 10 years since his passing.
Wow.
Next year, I think, and it doesn't time fly, and we would have been looking forward to another Kubrick movie about this time, I'm sure.
Yeah,
given the pace of his work.
Right.
But I understand the impetus for Fog City Mavericks. You talked about your relationship with Mr. Lucas, but it actually came from a suggestion by George Lucas, didn't it?
Yeah, I was actually working on a different project, and I was at a big meeting around a giant conference table at the ranch. The meeting was about a number of projects, and he just happened to say, you know, he had the dream, that his dream was that someday when archaeologists look back at San Francisco hundreds of years from now, there would be some record of there having been a film community there. And he was afraid that there was no record and that nobody was really even aware that there's a film community in San Francisco. And that really was an interesting concept, and that ended up blossoming and becoming becoming Fog City Mavericks.
Yeah, and you really do, you really are very good at pointing out what makes San Francisco so special and conducive to this kind of filmmaking movement. And it's been the case since the beginning of the medium. I was very taken aback because I personally did not know the story of Edward Muybridge.
Right. Well, neither did I. And I had no idea that Muybridge worked in San Francisco. I had no idea Charlie Chaplin worked in San Francisco and developed his character of the tramp there. And this is one of the things we touched on earlier, is that the sense of discovery that I as a filmmaker had as I did the research. This project took about 2.5 years to complete, and during that time there was a tremendous amount of research done on exactly what makes the San Francisco film community what it is today and what it is that makes each of these guys in some way related to each other. The thing is that the film covers people as diverse as George and as Chris Columbus, who did Home Alone and the first Harry Potter movie, and Clint Eastwood. And you don't look at these guys' films and think, well, obviously they're kind of from the same school, because they run the gamut in terms of subject matter and style. But what unites them, I discovered, and unites San Francisco filmmakers going back as far as you want to go, is a sense of independence, is a sense that they want to be left to their own devices in order to create their art without a lot of interference from the outside. And currently, nowadays, it's interference from Hollywood, of course.
Right.
And even in the early days, Chaplin left Max Sennett's studio, where he was kind of a hired hand, and wanted to get away and get out of Los Angeles to try to make his own way and make his own films that were more personal to him, which is what he did up in the San Francisco area.
yeah, I was thinking about this while I was watching it, because you know, you kind of can put the New York filmmaker in a box and you recognize that voice. But San Francisco isn't really that easy. I think one of the talents you interviewed referred to it as the United States version of Europe.
Yeah.
Those kind of films, yeah.
Yeah, those guys. It's funny you mentioned New York, because I've had this discussion with some of these guys. George, in particular, I know, feels that it's unfortunate that Marty Scorsese is thought of as a New York filmmaker, but George is not thought of as a San Francisco filmmaker.
Right.
And he would love to be. He would love to have this. In fact, all these guys feel very passionately about their community, that it is a community, that it's not just, oh, they work in Hollywood and they happen to live in San Francisco. They don't. They live in San Francisco. They do as much work as they can out of Hollywood. A lot of it's shot in the San Francisco area. Phil Kaufman has made almost all of his films in the San Francisco area. But that's not the focus of our film. Our film isn't about which movies were shot in San Francisco. Our focus is about this group of filmmakers who make their home there and who have established this independent community there.
But what is it about the area, and you go into this in the documentary, that makes it so unique and that breeds such great kind of artistic talent?
That's the million-dollar question, Jamie. And it's funny because I asked everyone that question. Every person I interviewed, I asked that question. My favorite answer was John Lasseter, who thinks it might be the wine, it might be the food, you know, or the fog coming in. You know, no one really knows. It's just been, I mean, at one point our film was much broader than it ended up being. Our film was, at one point, was going to incorporate the sexual revolution, gay rights, Alice Waters, and the culinary breakthroughs in San Francisco. It was going to be even broader than it is. Ultimately, we decided we really have to focus on cinema. And the interesting thing is, in all of those fields, and probably a lot of others, there is this sense of innovation being at the heart of the culture in San Francisco, the Silicon Valley being there, you know, personal computers being invented up there. You know, I don't know what it is. It's some kind of, I don't know, maybe some sort of one of those universal vortexes they talk about.
Yeah. Do you think there's a sense of isolation there? I mean, somewhat from...
No, I wouldn't look at it that way exactly, because San Francisco was a big city before Los Angeles was, because of the gold rush.
Right.
But maybe that has got something to do with it. I know Francis has talked about the fact that the gold rush brought in a whole group of people who were sort of outcasts and willing to take a risk, you know, to leave the big cities of the East and try to come west to make their fortune. And that maybe engendered a bit of the sort of independent spirit that you still see up there.
Well, I love the connections that you make in it between Edward Muybridge. You know, he really pioneered what we know now as the motion pictures, and that all came about because of a tragic accident that almost took his life. And I was unaware of this. The direction of George Lucas's life was changed by another near fatal accident.
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of people know that George, at the age of 18, I think it was maybe 19, right out of high school, right at the end of high school, had a near fatal car accident, and he had been he'd been a poor student prior to that, and he'd kind of bounced around. His interests were basically rock and roll and cars.
Right.
And when he almost was killed, he woke up and felt, well, okay, I survived against all odds, and it must be for a reason. And it kind of made him a little more serious about what he was going to do with his life. And I knew that story. And then I did my research into Edward Muybridge and discovered one of the real key creative moments in the process of making this film for me was this discovery that he had had a terrible stagecoach accident and almost died. And prior to that, he'd basically been a businessman, and he focused primarily on photographic books, which I guess, in a way, was kind of a way of being a filmmaker in those days.
Sure.
And he focused on photographic books and sold them. And then after the accident, he was kind of a changed man, and he decided he wanted to become an artist and be a photographer himself instead of just selling books. And that sort of parallel between the guy who basically invented motion pictures in San Francisco and George, who reinvented motion pictures in San Francisco, became the parallel tracks that the movie sort of connected on for me creatively. That was the big launching point creatively.
Yeah, and Lucas I find a fascinating figure, because especially hearing interviews with Coppola, and Coppola always said, look, I thought that Lucas would be one of our great avant-garde filmmakers. And obviously, as pointed out in the documentary, I mean, he's changed the way we see movies. So this isn't to say that he's sold himself short, but I'm wondering, do you feel like he's just scratched the surface of what he's capable of as a filmmaker?
Well, I would say he is one of our great avant-garde filmmakers. I think if you turn the sound down on Star Wars and watch some of the action sequences, the way the cutting works is just pure cinema. It's just a visceral experience that there's no other medium that can bring you that experience. So I think he actually took the avant-garde, his love for avant-garde filmmaking and his skills in that area, and brought it into popular filmmaking and made something which was avant-garde part of popular culture. But in terms of his future, I have no idea I don't think there are limits to him, and I know he's got more ideas than he'll ever have, you know, a lifespan to fulfill. I'm happy that he's directing again, and I'm happy that, you know, I really feel like at some point he's going to make good on the promise he keeps making, which is the desire to go back to making little films again, which Francis has done now. Francis Coppola just made his own film called Youth Without Youth, and he's making another one now that he's self-financing. So he's gone from making these big Apocalypse Now-size epics back into making little personal films. And George has been threatening to do that for years, and I think a lot of us hope he actually has the time and the inclination.
That would be fascinating, wouldn't it?
It would be.
You know, and Coppola, he feels reinvigorated, like he's back in film school, and he really was the first success of this film school generation of filmmakers. You know, and talk about parallels between Chaplin's studio and his own American Zoetrope. I'm wondering what's your impression of Coppola sitting one-on-one with him? What did you take away from him?
Well, he's an interesting guy because he's not just a filmmaker. At one point, and I think it was 1971, Francis owned a newspaper, a theater. He was writing operas. He was making films. He's got a varied background, and he comes from a family that's very culturally advanced. His father was the first chair in Toscanini's orchestra. He was a musician, and he's got musicians and artists on both sides of the family going back as far as Italy. So he brings this kind of cosmopolitan European sense to everything he does. He has that ebullient kind of almost like a Fellini character, and that's sort of the role that he plays, you know, in the circle of San Francisco filmmakers. He is the unquestioned center of that circle, and I think will be as long as he's around.
Yeah, I'm really moved by it. I've always been moved by the fact that he's a dreamer, and even if his aspirations exceed his grasp, I've always been inspired by that man.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. He's the reason I went to UCLA, because Francis went to UCLA.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm interested because you don't necessarily tell the story chronologically.
It must have been
tempting to do so. But explain your decision to structure the film as you did.
Well, as I said, we go back 125 years to the invention of motion pictures by Edward Muybridge, and I just felt that in a movie that's 2 hours, if you started at the beginning and told the story chronologically, people who were really only really interested in, you know, the guys they've heard of, the George Lucas, Francis Coppola group, would maybe not sit through what would end up being probably a half an hour of, you know, historical archival material.
Right.
So rather than do that, I wanted to find a structure that would give a sense of the sweep of history and the way history has unfolded in San Francisco and in cinema, while keeping you anchored to people you recognized and stories that were at least somewhat current. So what I did is I made parallel train tracks for the engine that drives the movie. The parallel train tracks are George's story and Francis's story. And then my task was to find transitions from telling their story, which is their stories are told in a chronological way, and then I found transitions from their stories to the past and to the future and back and forth, and that was the great creative challenge of the film. And so that's the approach that we took.
Well, yeah, there's so many parallels to work with there, too. The movie's called Fog City Mavericks. If our listeners look on the page that they're on right now, they'll see an image of the cover of the DVD. If you click on that, it'll take you right to Amazon where you can order it. I'm interested, before you leave us, I want your take on the future of cinema, because obviously you're invested heavily into cinema, and you work in the DVD market as well. I know that we talked to Paul Schrader a couple of weeks ago, and he was very pessimistic about the future of the theater-going experience. Do you see that going away, or how do you see that evolving?
I don't see it going away. I think it's going to evolve. The opinions I've heard from people I respect who know more than I know, which is some of which are in this movie, is that the theater-going experience is going to become much more luxurious. Large theaters, the Arclight sort of model, if you're familiar with the Arclight theater here in California.
Yeah.
And that people will go out and it'll be more of an event, because so much of it's going to be coming into your home, either over the Internet or whatever other method they're going to be inventing next. But I do think the communal experience of being in an audience with other people to see the same, you know, movie or theater or whatever, I think that's deep in the bones for human beings, and I don't think that's going to ever go away entirely.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Well, Mr. Leva, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I really, really enjoy the work you do.
Thank you very much.
Please come back anytime you'd like. Any future project that you have, just feel free to call in. Let us know all about it.
All right, terrific. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is Gary Leva, director of Fog City Mavericks, The Filmmakers of San Francisco, which is available on DVD right now, and it's actually available with a click of your mouse on the page you're on right now. Yeah, so that was my conversation with Gary Leva yesterday about Fog City Mavericks. Really kind of interesting, and certainly for guys like me and you, Jerry.
Yeah, I know. It was great. Very enlightening.
Yeah, and I mean, he sat with Giants and Eastwood. You know, he's Carmel, but you know, he's closely associated with San Francisco filmmakers as well.
Yeah, he is.
And he spotlights in the documentary. And what was fascinating to me, I talked about the parallels in the documentary, how life changing events really steered a lot of these people in the direction of
to
become artists. Same thing with Coppola. Coppola had polio as a child.
Yeah, he was very ill.
He was paralyzed for many months.
Yeah.
And that really sparked his desire to be an artist, he said.
Yes, it did, yeah.
And then Lucas's near-death experience, and then who essentially was the inventor of the motion picture camera, Muybridge.
Yeah.
Same thing. It really kind of interesting.
Oh, no, it sounds great. I'm going to definitely pick that up. It sounds fascinating. That was a really good interview.
Thank you. I just, I have a soft spot for Coppola, you know, and I know there's probably a certain amount of ego there, I think. There's ego there that turns some people off with Coppola.
Can I address that? You have to have an ego to be an artist, a writer or a director or an actor. That takes a certain level of ego. It's not something that, for the most part, it's not something that, you know, a shy person can. But I'm just saying, you do have to be successful. You got to be a hustler. You got to have an ego.
Right.
I think so. I don't find
it
alienating.
He's even said the same thing.
Yeah.
He said, look, just the notion that you make something and you expect people to show up and look at it, there's a certain amount of ego involved in that.
No one wants to say, oh, I'm going to make a movie, but I hope no one comes to see it, you know? I mean,
I just find it hard. I'm just hard-pressed to find someone who is more passionate about movies and puts their money where their mouth is, you know, so often. I mean, he put his whole livelihood on the line with The Godfather and Apocalypse Now and some one from the heart, and that didn't work.
Yeah, he did it. Remember, they always had to put the house on the market each time.
Yeah, he did exactly what people say don't do.
Yeah.
But his opinion was, how could I not?
Yeah.
I am completely heart and soul invested in this project. This is a given that I'm going to put everything I own up for it.
No,
and then
talk
about a family that supported him, and especially his wife that... I don't know that we'd have a couple of without.
No, Eleanor definitely is the backbone there. There's no doubt about that. No doubt.
But it's very, you kind of watch the documentary and you're very wistful for, you know, that time when George Lucas and Coppola first met. You know, there's the future of cinema right there, you know.
Yeah, I know. We don't know where it's going, but I was happy to hear what he had to say. That hopefully it will always be around, the theater-going experience. I really can't imagine just strictly being at home in your room on the computer experience.
Yeah, but he almost said something similar to Schrader, in that it's going to be this is what Schrader said, that it's like a night out of the theater.
Well, I see that, like the Arc Light, and it's very pricey too. I do see that, but I hope there's still theaters. I really do.
There's an interesting article. It's very lengthy, that Armand White just wrote recently.
We're going to be watching them on the wristwatches? Is that what he said?
That might have been one thing he said, but it was mostly about film criticism, the state of film criticism.
Right.
And he is very critical of the state of film criticism.
Yeah, we know firsthand.
But it's a fascinating read. Essentially, it comes down to movies have been too much accepted as a mass entertainment product.
Right.
And too dismissed as, you know, our greatest art form in the past century.
Right.
And that's really reflected in our film criticism, which a lot of what he had to say, I found it hard to disagree with. I mean, he made some very valid points. You know, and these were artists, and a lot of the critics of the 70s that were smart enough, the Saris and the Kale,
mm-hmm.
to really recognize these people that were coming up in the 70s.
Right.
I mean, they helped to elevate our view of movies as an art form.
Right. No, yeah, I see that, definitely.
Yeah, but he was critical of Roger Ebert. And if you notice, that there have been many, many articles from high-profile writers appraising Ebert as of late.
But not it's not going to come from Armand White.
No.
He
was kind of careful. And that he said, you know, I wish Roger Ebert nothing but health. But he was very insightful, too. He said, you'll notice, nowhere in these tributes did they point out a particular line, a quote, any excerpt from his writings that pointed to his insightfulness about film as an art form.
Right.
Which is, you know, worth stating.
That's true. I mean, he's got that. That is a valid point. I mean, I can think of several just reading his reviews and books of reviews. But yeah, I mean, the A.O. Scott appraisal on the Times a couple of weeks ago didn't mention anything. They
right.
really talk about the whole thumbs up, thumbs down thing almost.
Yeah, and it's personally, I think it's a shame if the thumbs up, thumbs down is his legacy, which it probably will be.
Yeah.
I mean, because it just caught on like wildfire.
Right.
Because that really points out film criticism as Consumer Reports.
Well, I think it's a problem with a lot of it, whether it's that or Entertainment Weekly with the grades or the star system or a rating of 1 to 10. I mean, you're telling someone, oh, you should go see this or you shouldn't go see that, and I try not to do that if I write a review or whatever. I'm just much more interested in talking about the film. I feel uncomfortable ever telling someone, because how do I know? You know, the person might love the film if you don't like it, you know? You can't make up someone's mind for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you and I talk about this all the time, that we have films that are very personal to us.
Yeah.
That it doesn't matter what anyone else says, and we can't... They're not things that you can reason away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There are many films that I love in spite of their faults.
Right, exactly.
Many I love because of their faults. Mm-hmm. You know, makes it what it is. You know, it's very interesting. I'd love to have a film criticism roundtable, and really explore how they critique movies, what the criteria is for a well-rounded review.
That's it. That'd be very interesting. Yeah, have it on with Armand White and have some others on. That would be very interesting.
Yeah, and Armand was one of the first. Big interviews that we did. It was for the De Palma tribute,
right.
And he's a very vocal De Palma devotee.
Yes, he is.
And
he is.
It was quite enlightening. And I remember, making the phone call to him. I had to call him personally and ask him to take part in it. And you know, he's very authoritative. I mean, that voice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is. That is definitely the word for it.
I remember going through the De Palma, and then at the end he made a comment about Casualties of War, and he said, I don't know if you remember this, he said, let's be clear about this. It's better than Apocalypse Now in every way imaginable.
Yeah, I do remember that.
And I know that Chris sometimes can't bite his tongue, and I know that Chris, like, completely disagrees with that. He loves Casualty.
I disagree with it, too. So,
yeah.
Two different movies, to be quite honest with you, but...
Right. So I made sure that at that moment I cut the interview.
Right.
Like, well, that's all the time we have. I'm so sorry. But a very interesting man with interesting ideas.
Yeah.
If you find that you're wanting something to see on the internet, New York Press, I think he writes for.
Yeah, that's always worth a look. You'll get some. You'll not see The View repeated anywhere else.
Yeah, it is a good read. He's one of the controversial critics because I think like Kale, he embraces the pop culture-ness. The pop culture influence in film.
Right.
Too.
I definitely see that with some of the things, like some of the choices he's made, definitely he's embracing. Sometimes just also, sometimes almost just to be contrarian, but also just to, because he really, you know, likes it, you know, I mean.
Right. And he'll say something like, you know, he'll praise I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of. That's the one
which
he did, praised right before he came on the show, I think.
And then he'll take something like There Will Be Blood. And he made a point about There Will Be Blood. He said, you know, There Will Be Blood is a movie with masterpiece all over it, essentially is what he said. But it's a movie made to be admired and honored and not necessarily felt, you know, which was an interesting point.
I could see the point, but I think it is to be felt. But I could actually see if he presented a good argument, I could see where, because I know a lot of people who don't like the movie. A lot of people
right.
that just left them cold. They didn't know what they were supposed to get out of it. So I can totally see his point. I absolutely adore the movie, but it's right up my alley. But I can see where someone would walk away with that opinion.
Yeah, I adore the movie too. Yet another movie I have on my shelf is that I haven't been able to get to yet is Youth Without Youth.
Oh, that's already out on DVD?
It comes out next month. Yeah.
Okay, well, you're lucky.
We're waiting for our callers to call. We actually had one call show up and then it disappeared. I don't know if we scared them off by our
phantom caller.
I don't know. It was our
phantom caller.
I think it was the caller of our next guest, and then they disappeared. So hopefully they'll call back in.
I hope so. Because
I have their interview all set up and ready to go, and I'm very excited about talking to them. In the meantime, our chat room seems to be extra sleepy tonight.
Yeah.
We're not getting a lot of involvement out
there.
No,
we're not. Well, I'm afraid because one of our guests in there, James, can't listen to it. I don't know. He can't hear it. He's having audio problems.
Yeah, there have been problems as of late. I've heard many people.
But he could hear the archive show. Now, let me ask you this: does he have an Apple computer? Oh, look at Garney. He's type Z. Got always the quick. Thing.
Garney man, why don't you call in and give us some company for a little bit? Tell
us
about the show you're in, and tell us if you've seen anything good as of late in the movie theater.
Or just type it if you want. I mean, besides the Z's.
Yep. I rewatched a couple of classics.
Yeah, you told me. Tell everyone what you rewatched.
Yeah, Annie Hall, which is very emotional. Movie for Woody Allen, and I of course I'd seen it before, but many years ago, and I was kind of refreshing myself to it. Very funny and innovative. I mean, there was a time when Woody Allen was very innovative. Yeah, the school children, he says, I often wonder what
That's
the school kids are up to today.
That was classic. And when that one guy said an insurance executive, I burst out laughing.
I used to be a heroin addict. I'm now a methadone addict. And then the other little girl says, I'm into leather.
Yep. Yeah, dude, that's a class. You know, that's also timeless, though. I could watch it over and over again. And
it really is timeless. And there has never been a better pairing with Woody Allen than Diane Keaton.
Mm-hmm. That's the
There's
best.
Just the spark that you can't define. You know, her eccentricity with his kind of.
No, it was perfect.
Yeah, it works so well. And then I watched In the Heat of the Night.
God, I haven't seen that in a long time.
Which we just discussed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the Heat of the Night, and fantastic movie, and definitely tackling issues ahead of its time, you know.
Oh yeah, it's old.
Yeah, yeah, and fantastic performances. I just remember the power of Rod Steiger. I mean, what a powerful presence.
Yeah, no, he was always good. I liked him in a lot of things, but I also reading that book, he had to really travel for work though. It didn't come easily, the roles and things. He had to really fight. It seems like a lot to get good roles.
Okay, so I'm seeing like different numbers show up. Our guest number showed up, and now a different number is showing up. I want to make sure this is not one of our listeners before we start the interview segment. So I'm asking Garney a question. Since we invited him to call in, I want to make sure it's not him and it's one of our guests.
I'm waiting for Garney to respond.
Yes, of course he's...
it's 210,
This is him. And we're still... Our guest number showed up like twice, flickered on and then shut right back off.
Wait, twice, so like, you know, like... In a row, or
yeah. Garney man.
Yeah, they call me Mr. G.
Great. I mean, we're getting. Dude, is there anything you can't do?
I recorded my next Radiohead cover for tomorrow. It's gonna be Kermit the Frog.
Oh my god.
It's great. It's quite a rage you get there, man.
Yeah.
You gotta wake us up. I mean, the chat room's falling asleep. I don't know what's going on tonight.
Yeah, well, I heard you were talking about Annie Hall, so I decided to call in because the last movie I saw in the theater was Cassandra's Dream finally came around to my side.
Yeah, how was that?
It's good. You know, it's always good to see Woody Allen do something more serious. Being so close and so similar to Match Point. And also, Jerry brought up in his review that it was very similar to Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
It's hard to escape that comparison.
Exactly. But I enjoyed it. I mean, the characters were very well established, and it moved really well. The difference between it and Match Point is a better film.
It is.
But Match Point took a while to get started. And then it just gripped you and kept you in its clutches, whereas Cassandra's Dream started out interesting, and then it took too long to end, because it got to a certain point where the film started writing itself, where you knew where it was going to go, and it sort of gone past that element of surprising you.
Yeah, you knew it was going to end bad, and you just knew it wasn't going to be... you know, puppies and ice cream, that's for sure.
Right. I mean, just in the title alone, Cassandra's Dream. Assuming that's the reference to the, the Cassandra character that is always, foreseeing terrible things happening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Cassandra's Dream marks the first time Woody Allen's done something in one of his films. What is it?
Philip Glass's score.
Yeah.
That's
which
right.
was excellent. It reminded me of something out of Hitchcock.
Yeah. It's really weird because you're so used to when those credits come on, they hear the jazz music.
Uh-huh.
I'm so used to that, just program. Then it's like, I was like, holy shit, that's Philip Glass,
And you've heard about his next film, right?
I mean,
there's Vicky Cristy Barcelona.
No, forget that. The Larry David one. I mean.
Exactly. Larry David falling in love with.
Let's not forget his next film. Because we're talking about Scarlett Johansson and Penelope Cruz.
No one's making.
Apparently there's some.
Javier Bardem.
There's some steamy stuff in this movie, and it premieres at Cannes, actually.
Well, we can go.
Today. But the Larry David being Woody Allen's alter ego, I mean, is there more perfect casting? I mean, there's not.
It's
and the
perfect.
The plot line of this one, he falls in love with a much younger woman.
Right.
write what you know.
Yep.
Which Woody Allen movie is this?
Yeah, really.
The one Larry David, and I think his love interest is played by Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah.
But it's the same stuff that's obsessed him his whole career. You know.
Yeah. But Larry David is going to be great, though.
I can't wait.
They're made for each other.
Yeah, I adore Larry David, man, and he's. I know you're on my wavelength if you like Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's like my litmus test for people. You know, sit down, watch this episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. If you're into it, you're my kind of person. And
yeah, well, you had said earlier you'll call in and talk about your show. I mean, I'm doing the Neil Simon's Broadway Bound.
Right.
The part that I play, Stanley, was originally played by Jason Alexander. So as I was preparing for the role, I was like a lot of George Costanza slips in, and I even do the Larry David look into the character's eyes to see if they're telling the truth. Totally, just steal it, you know.
Right.
I have no qualms in just admitting it.
Yeah, the best actors steal from the best actors.
Exactly. I look at it as a tribute.
Exactly.
There you go.
And people like Scorsese, I mean, they look at it as outright theft. And, you know, I'm not afraid to admit it. Yeah, I stole that. Larry David. And do you think there'll be more seasons of Curb? Are they talking about it?
It's supposed to be two, I thought. Two more.
Yeah. But how can you not keep going after that season finale
with
the Black family?
Yes. That's like if my last name were Jew.
Yeah, I know.
Classic. I love that comedy. I love that kind of uncomfortable comedy.
Oh, and last season was so uncomfortable. I mean...
And it's just come into the fold. I mean, it's kind of like a new thing, isn't it? Like the past, since maybe the Farrelly brothers... They're more outrageous, but this uncomfortable comedy, it's kind of a new trend.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you got to go back to, like, Ricky Gervais's The Office.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's a master.
And the American version, too.
The American version, they were smart, knowing that they were going to go longer than two seasons, where they made the character of Michael Scott bearable.
Right.
They give him that different personality where you can see how, like, working with him is terrible, but he's still a good guy.
Right. No, you're right.
And with Ricky Gervais's character, I mean, he definitely doesn't intend to be the jerk that he is, but he just always is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you guys can continue the conversation, I'm typing an email to our guest. Maybe there was a mix-up because I saw the number appear twice, but it didn't appear long enough for me to patch them in after and read their introduction. So I'm making sure that they know that we can reschedule.
Okay. No. Yeah, I think that Curb is definitely one of the best, you know, sitcoms there is. I just enjoy it. It's very rare these days I'll really laugh out loud at something on TV, but that show manages to do it.
Yeah, because if they lose that, I mean, HBO, they need to come up with some more good original programming that's new.
Yeah.
Now they're losing The Wire this year. And The Sopranos going off.
And 6 Feet Under a couple of years ago, I mean.
Right. All the greats are going, and the new ones that have been coming in, with the exception of Flight of the Conchords.
And Entourage, I mean.
Entourage is good, but I think Entourage is reaching that point where it's...
You think it's going to jump the shark or already has, or...
I don't think it already has, but they need to do something with it, and I don't know what else they can do with it. Like, get them out of Hollywood and... You know, because whenever they go to film something, it's only a couple episodes.
Right.
Why not make it a whole season of them filming on location?
That would be
interesting.
I agree. What other? See, the Rome was only two seasons. Deadwood they cut short.
And I, like I had said before, I wasn't that big a fan of In Treatment.
Jamie loved that show. I never got around to watching a lot of it, so I don't know.
I'm really looking forward to the Generation Kill miniseries coming up in July.
That's a great book that that's based on is an excellent book by Evan Wright, so I'm really looking forward to that.
I didn't know about the book. I just know that it's by the same producers as The Wire.
Right. No, but it was a great book. He's a journalist for Rolling Stone. I read it kind of a while ago, but it's a really good book about the early days of the Iraq War and about the soldiers. I strongly recommend it. But
you know, compare Curb to Seinfeld. Obviously, Larry David was a brainchild for Seinfeld as well. You know, and were either one of you guys a Seinfeld devotee?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Not at first.
I didn't start watching it religiously until I guess 93 probably.
Uh huh.
But I did once I got hooked. I was hooked. You know.
See, for me, and maybe I'm off base because I didn't watch enough of them, but for me, Seinfeld was, like, the least interesting character out of the whole bunch.
But you're right.
He was surrounded by colorful people.
Yeah.
With me, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you can't get more fascinating than Larry David.
Exactly.
Yeah, and he was sort of I always felt that, it, you know, watching Curb, it was Larry David who was really the genius behind Seinfeld, ironically. It's like... I think Jerry Seinfeld's a talented fellow and all that, but Larry David is really the genius behind it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think with Seinfeld, you have a lot more of that Newhart aspect where you have a sane person surrounded by crazy people,
mm-hmm.
except the sane person is also trying to be funny, and Newhart was never trying to be funny.
That's right. That's
and the genius in Curb Your Enthusiasm is it's kind of the same thing, except it's someone who feels like he should be a Newhart. Where
right.
everyone around him is crazy, but no one is really as crazy as he is.
He's insane.
Yeah,
he's such an original figure on television, and all of his faults I can identify with. I know where he's coming from. I can sympathize with him, even at the times when he makes me cringe the most. It's a very special character, and apparently, I mean, he's really vocal that, you know, this isn't a character, this is really me, and I find it hard to believe that that's a gimmick. I really think that's him.
I mean, don't
you guys get that sense?
Oh, yeah, I don't think this is an act. I really, if it's an act, it's an incredible act. But
I think he pushes it further.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he makes the character more, you know, clueless and more brazen than he really is.
Yeah.
I think he recognizes, you know, where the line is as far as what's funny for writing, and he also recognizes where the line is in reality, where not to go that Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm goes.
Right.
Right. There is something, too, to be said. I mean, HBO, like you said, Garney, I mean, they're in a tight spot because they've lost all of their major shows with The Sopranos and The Wire and Sex and the City years ago and you know, hopefully not Curb, but... So they really are in need of a reinvention again.
Yeah.
Tells you how tough the business is. But do you think even as popular as Sex and the City was on HBO, do you think that will translate into big dollars in the box office this summer with that movie?
I don't know.
I see it having a big opening weekend and then phasing away.
Yeah. I was thinking about
big drop. Because a lot of people are waiting for it, and all those people are going to go when it opens. And I mean, I never watched Sex and the City. I don't care. And
well,
if you
think it's like a big show for HBO, I don't know how many numbers it pulled up, but a big show for HBO would be something like, I mean, comparatively to Sopranos, maybe 16 million,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't enough to make a hit at the box office.
No, it's not.
But the one thing that it does have in its favor is, you know, it's caught on DVDs and replays. What do they call it? It's syndication.
And it's
the female movie of the summer. I mean, you know, that's a powerful market that is untapped. It could be. I think it could be this year's Devil Wears Prada. I mean,
that's what I was thinking. Yeah, cause, and also Candace Bushnell, the author, is very popular. Her books do very well. So I think it has. It definitely has the. Whether that's the weekend after Indiana Jones. That has the potential to be like counter-programming for that weekend. So.
Which bodes well for Indiana Jones, too. I mean, Indiana Jones has two full weeks, you know, unless Postal sneaks up on it.
you never know, man.
Yeah, Garney liked our Uwe Boll interview last week. He was commenting on it at another show the other night, so...
Yeah.
You see the speed racer and the Narnia 2. It's so crappy, but it's way better. It's way better than...
I have another theory. Yeah, that was hysterical. I was imitating it for my mother and trying to give her a sense of how honest and how much candor he brought to the show. And
I hope you'll do Uwe Boll doing Radiohead.
I think Iron Man will be a good movie and it'll do good, and Speed Racer and Prince Narnia, I think they will both suck big time.
So it reminded me of like a cross between Arnold Schwarzenegger and the duck in the Walt Disney cartoons that explains math.
That's good.
He was kind of endearing to me, you know? And,
oh, yeah.
That was a great interview. I loved
awesome
every second
interview.
Of it.
And I think some people had a problem that I didn't pick a fight with him or try to get him riled up or something.
Well, we got him
riled
up.
You invited him, didn't you? Why are you going to invite him for
a
fight?
And I was like, exactly.
Why
that
would
was
we
exactly,
do that?
Yeah.
I mean,
I wanted to do. I didn't. If you see, I didn't give really an opinion on his work very much, but I took him seriously, which I don't think a lot of.
I'd much rather listen to that interview again than watch any of his movies. Well, I am interested in Postal, but I just, like you, I don't know the video game genre.
It's a hard. We were talking about that at work. It just doesn't. I don't think that. I think they're fine. Video games are awesome, but I don't think most of the time they just don't translate well to movies. I don't.
Yeah.
In terms of a business decision, and I don't know that we've had any box office that supports this, though. You would think that it would be smart. I mean, to target the youth market by adapting a popular video game.
They try, even with that one. Well, I mean, Halo, I guess. They're trying to do that.
You think
that,
the Halo would be the first blockbuster of that kind of genre?
Yeah.
I think if you did, like, a Grand Theft Auto movie the right way,
that could be enormously
well.
Because those games do so well, they make more than movies. I mean,
yeah, there's
well,
people talking. There's executives worrying about how well Iron Man is going to do because it's coming out 3 days after Grand Theft Auto 4.
I mean, oh god.
Yeah, it's a real. That's a real strong consideration now.
It is
video game market, and you're right. In a day, a video game will gross, you know, what a film grosses in its entire run. You're talking about bringing profits of $60 million in a weekend on a video game. you know, it's incredible. It's mind-boggling.
Yes, it is. It is.
I'm waiting for the Super Monkey Ball movie, actually. I don't know if anyone remembers that game.
Super Monkey Ball?
I don't. What game? This
is that somewhere to Congo Bongo?
I don't know. I don't know video
Congo
games very
Bongo.
Well. Personally, I like the old school games. I like the Galaga and the Pac-Man and that kind of stuff. But this was like, and I don't even know what game console it was. There was PlayStation, there was Xbox, and then there was that little GameCube.
GameCube.
Yeah, this game was part of the GameCube format.
Well, man, you should write the script and, you know, sell it, you know.
Super Monkey Ball.
Yeah, I want to write a script for Bust a Move where you have all these weird characters that have to shoot, like, little colored balls and other colored balls to save other people.
I'm waiting for a really killer cinematic depiction of Pong, because I don't think we've gotten there yet.
I don't know if I'd be really in line for that, but yeah, sure.
you're not open for that, man?
Well, I mean, who's going to play the two, the paddles?
Who's going to play the paddles? That's classic. Garty, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you
very much. Hey, my pleasure.
Company.
All right,
thanks, guys. I'm a real big fan. Long time listener, first time caller.
Thank you.
All right.
I'll talk
later,
to
you
guys too. Bye, man. Hysterical.
That was.
Yeah, he's very funny.
He's very talented. I mean, he does all those great voices and everything for those Radiohead songs.
Daniel Plainview, I know.
Daniel Plainview is awesome.
It's incredible. Okay, I believe our next guest is up and ready to go.
Let's do it.
And so let's do this. And I send an email to our previous guest to try to reschedule that segment. I'm not sure what happened there. Maybe it was a drop call. So I'm hoping it wasn't our fault. But our next guest is here. We're very excited about this. Let's start this segment right now.
He had the film, but he wasn't sure the audiences were going to come. I am taking this huge risk. I've mortgaged the house. How do I make sure that the audiences come? That fear, and he was driven by fear, you know, made his mind work.
Your attention, please. During every suspenseful moment of the running of the motion picture Macabre, the life of everyone in this theater will be insured by Lloyd's of London for $1,000 against death by fright.
Every picture has to have a gimmick, something to sell. You must have some sort of a campaign plan.
If you were in the movie and you dropped dead, your beneficiary would collect $1,000.
He went to Lloyd's of London and got a legitimate policy. When people went to see the movie, they filled out the beneficiary slip.
I was so obsessed by the insurance policy of dying by fright. And I went thinking someone would die, and that's the reason that they had these insurance policies, and obviously people were dying in the movie theater.
That's a clip from the new documentary Spine Tingler, the William Castle story. And William Castle was one of a sadly extinct breed, a true showman in the film business, whose endlessly creative gimmicks lured moviegoers to his endearing line of B-movie spectacles. Much like Hitchcock, he was one of the first filmmakers to become a brand name. And when you saw the name William Castle, you knew that you were in for a theater-going experience unlike any other. Producer-director Jeffrey Schwartz paints a loving and heartfelt portrait of Castle, embracing all of the eccentricities as well as Castle's longing to be considered a serious filmmaker in Spine Tingler. Mr. Schwartz has one of the most impressive resumes I've ever seen. I don't know if you've... Have you looked him up in IMDb, Jerry? It's an incredible resume.
Yeah, we need someone like him today.
Exactly. He has produced and directed a series of examinations on many of our greatest timeless masterpieces and the cinematic artists who brought them to life. And his passion for the artist and the art form is infectious, and it drives all of his outstanding works. Spine Tingler took home the Audience Award at the AFI Fest and the Best Feature Documentary Award at the Magnolia Independent Film Fest as well. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show a true movie geek. Yes, he is truly one of us, Mr. Jeffrey Schwartz.
One of
Jeffrey,
us.
Are you... Jeffrey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. That was quite an introduction.
Well, we're honored to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm honored to be here.
So tell us about your love of movies. Obviously, you're crazy about them as much as we are. Where did that love begin?
You know, that's a good question. If somebody asked me that before, you know, what was the first movie you remember seeing? I think it was Network. And I don't know why my parents took me to see Network. I don't remember what year that was. What was it, like 73?
76.
Okay.
76.
Okay, 76. So they took me. The only thing I remember is Howard Beale getting assassinated. And I guess they couldn't find a babysitter that night. And then I remember Young Frankenstein pretty well. And
yeah.
I'm sure there were movies before that, but I guess those were the...
But those are two really good ones to start with.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I think so too. Especially Young Frankenstein. I think that was probably like a lot of people. That for me, that was made a big impression because I was really into monsters and monster movies. My dad took us to see it, and he told us it was going to be really scary. So we were actually prepared for a horror movie, but it was hilarious, of course. So that combination of humor and horror, I think, is definitely all over. Spine Tingler, you know, and I think William Castle had that. He didn't make he made a few outright comedies, but his films were not meant to be comedies. I think if you see them now with an audience, you'd think they were meant to be comedies, but they're not.
Right, right. They're fun, and they kind of inspire audience participation, which is nice.
Absolutely.
But your company, much like our first guest tonight, it specializes in kind of producing the DVD added features, the documentaries and such.
Right. Automat Pictures is my company here in Los Angeles. And by a roundabout way, I started producing DVD content because of this William Castle project. Back in, I guess, the mid or the late 90s, I wanted to get this movie off the ground. And I kind of naively went to Sony, who owned and still owns most of Castle's major films, and said, hey, I want to make this documentary about William Castle. And I had a little pitch reel with interviews that I had shot with, like, Fredel and Ray and the guy from the local video store, you know, really low rent. And I met a guy there who was just hired to kind of run the DVD marketing department and was in the process of trying to figure out how to get people to buy DVDs, and the whole added value thing was just starting for DVD because it was really the beginning of the format. And of course, you know, big major motion picture studios are not in the business of making documentary feature films, but he did say, well, I like your work, and we're going to be releasing The Tingler on DVD, so why don't you just make a little documentary about The Tingler? And that was my first job as a DVD producer.
Oh, wow.
And that's kind of the genesis of the whole project. And then over the years, they just kept assigning me more William Castle movies to do. And in the meantime, I started working for other studios and doing much bigger titles. I ended up doing 5 William Castle movies for Sony and these little featurettes, which was a lot of fun, but always wanting to keep, you know, keeping the hope of doing the feature alive. And then independently of all that, I just kept shooting interviews, and Sony let me keep the interviews that I shot for them, which was very cool. Then they did not have to do that,
right?
And and then made the movie. The movie was made completely independently. It wasn't done through a studio or anything like that. So,
yeah, and it's a really surprisingly loving portrait, and it really captures the spirit of who William Castle was. And I definitely want to get into that. I just had a couple of questions about some of these other works that you've done on DVD. I was wondering. One of the most acclaimed was you did some Blue Velvet documentary work, didn't you?
Right. We did a documentary called Mysteries of Love, and that was
fantastic.
Thanks. That was a pretty amazing opportunity. And those don't come along very often. I mean, the work I do for DVD, I love the work, but there are some that really stand out that they're just, it's just an amazing opportunity because you couldn't make a lot of these things, and you certainly couldn't make them independently because getting access to materials and clips is really difficult. and with Blue Velvet, of course, you know, that was one of my favorite movies. It still is one of my favorite movies, so it was a tall order to make something, you know, up to the caliber of that film. And all these things have different personalities. I mean, the personality of a making of Blue Velvet is going to have a completely different personality than Fargo or
Exactly. Or
Elm Street or Silence of the Lambs or even like Resident Evil 3, you know. So that one, we actually did an interesting soundscape for that. We got the original sound effects library that Alan Splett created, and we tried to layer it and make it a... We didn't try to mimic Blue Velvet, but we tried to make it a more hypnotic kind of documentary. David Lynch was aware and interested in what we were doing, but since then he's done more interviews and talked about his work more openly, but at that time he didn't want to do an interview. We ended up finding a vintage interview of him from 1986. So everyone else in that piece, you know, Kyle MacLachlan and Isabella Rossellini and everybody, Angelo Badalamenti, they've all done new interviews, but... David Lynch's interview is back in 1986, so
Believe me, we know how difficult it is to get Mr. Lynch.
Yeah. Oh, have you tried to get him for something?
Many, many, many times.
I see. Well, I think he's a little more open to it now, but he'll never do like an audio commentary.
Right.
Are you allowed to curse on this show?
Yeah.
Anything you want to say.
He said that audio commentaries are horse shit.
Right.
Which is
well, for his brand of movies, I would think so.
Oh yeah, but I mean, but he's a great storyteller too.
Yeah,
if you've seen him on like the Eraserhead DVD, or I mean, he's hilarious. So
you know, and I think a lot of people make mistake of trying to when they speak to him, you know, explain this to me. I don't want him to explain any of his.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I like that mystique.
Exactly. That was his fear, I think, of being interviewed about his work. But yeah, that was a really great opportunity, and
so
they come along every once in a while in doing this kind of work.
So with all these filmmakers that you've had the opportunity to sit across from in this line of work that you're in, is there one out there that you would still love to explore that you haven't been able to yet?
You mean one that I have not worked with yet or met yet?
Yeah, or profiled or.
That's a good question. You know, doing these things, I've actually got to meet a lot of my childhood heroes. You know, I got to meet and work with and become friends with even some of them, like Joe Dante. We did The Howling, and John Carpenter. We did The Fog. We did Friday the 13th, and Wes Craven. We did Nightmare on Elm Street. So it's a good question you ask, but I've actually gotten to meet and work with some of these just amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, really it's great. It's great, and we get to make. I think we get to make shows that people will want to revisit. It's sort of like those great articles in Fangoria in the 80s and Fantastique.
Exactly.
I mean, these are things that hopefully will, they're kind of timeless. I mean, I guess you can make one of these every 10 years or so about a vintage film, and people's perspectives will change with time. But, you know, Blue Velvet, I think that's something I hope that people are still watching. And you know, I don't really ever know who's watching these things. So when you brought that one up, I'm really happy to hear that people are interested in this work and watching.
Oh, I've seen countless numbers of the credits on your resume. I'm telling you, Jerry, if you go and you look at his resume,
yeah, no,
it's like a never-ending scroll.
Yeah, I mean, you've met like so many people
and
interviewed them. I have to ask, did you get to interview Tarantino?
I never interviewed Tarantino. I did a piece for IFC about Reservoir Dogs.
Right.
And he did not want to be interviewed for that. I think that was because he was in the middle of Kill Bill.
Oh, okay.
Or I might be wrong about that. I don't remember the details. But we did it was like a tribute piece. But we actually got a bunch of the actors and fans, and it was sort of a tribute piece that that IFC did. And I don't know if it's been seen since we did that. That's the great thing about DVD is that as long as they're in print, people can keep seeking them out and watching them.
Right.
Yeah.
That piece, I don't know what happened to that.
Well, just know that pieces like yours, that's the first thing that I watch on any DVD I buy.
Good. See, the studios, there's conflicting data on that, and they always point to these marketing surveys that they do with consumers, And of course, the number one thing that they say people want to see on a DVD is bloopers, and you know that no one cares about the documentaries. But that
the documentaries are the best part.
I think so.
The bloopers are
Well, you guys are discerning viewers, you know.
Yeah, the bloopers. I mean, all right, so so and so like spilled coffee on himself, or
right.
You know, who cares?
Yeah, I agree. But I think they. I mean, the surveys that they do are with more mainstream consumers, and I think. The a studio like New Line, I've gotten the opportunity to make so much great stuff for them because they actually respect guys like you and people who have discerning taste. I mean, we did Nightmare on Elm Street for them, and you know they're very clear. They give me very clear directive about not doing anything or showing anything that's already been done. They don't
right.
like to double dip, and if they're going to double dip, they're going to do it right. They're going to really like Nightmare on Elm Street. That DVD was completely new. It was a complete reinvention of what it
right.
was before, and we even went back to the original work print, and we found material that no one's ever seen. You know, that's
yeah.
in that documentary and spread out on the DVD there. So,
you do fantastic work, and Spine Tingler is a fantastic work as well.
Thank you.
And if you could give our audience a sense of who Castle was, how did he find himself in the film business?
William Castle, well, he started off as being William Schloss, and he was a kid who became an orphan when he was pretty young. His parents died one after the other, a year apart, and he was an orphan living in New York City and kind of growing up on the streets, but also being very attracted to the theater. And he actually started his career as he claims to have worked on the Bela Lugosi production of Dracula. He became a bit player and then an actor on Broadway in Broadway shows. He was a stage director and a stage manager as well. But he got the movie bug and he went to Hollywood, not really knowing anybody. And he ended up getting a job at Columbia Pictures, and that was at a time where you actually could start off on the ground floor at a movie studio and learn every single facet of the movie business, which is what he did. And he ended up doing pretty much every job at Columbia. He befriended Harry Cohn, who was running the studio, who was kind of a notorious studio head that everybody hated. But for some reason, Castle got along with him. And he ended up being a dialogue director and then eventually got to start directing B-movies, these sort of one-hour-long programmers. And he did a whole bunch of those, and then he started doing these different genres all throughout the 50s, westerns and melodramas and biblical epics and film noir films. And he didn't really, all the films that he did before the more famous horror films and the gimmick films, they're, with a couple exceptions, they're all pretty much forgotten. They're not, they don't really have this an auteur stamp on them. They're basically work for hire things. And it wasn't until he went independent with his first horror film called Macabre that he started developing his persona as a showman and started coming up with these gimmicks. And the reason he came up with the first gimmick, which was ensuring the audience against death by fright, that was for a movie called Macabre. The reason he did that is because he financed that film himself. I mean, he mortgaged his house to finance that film. So he had an enormous amount riding on that. I mean, he was sort of betting the farm on the fact that horror was popular again after Diabolique and the Hammer films in the late 50s, and he made Macabre, which didn't really have any big stars, but it had this genius marketing campaign that he created, which was to insure the audience against death by fright through a legitimate insurance company. It was Lloyd's of London, and I always thought maybe this was a hoax or something, but it was actually, he actually did take out that insurance policy. I saw it in his papers.
And I will say that this screening of your movie that I attended, there were several ample-bodied females in nurses' outfits handing out duplicates of this insurance policy,
yep.
And it was great fun. It got the screening off to a great start.
Damn,
where did you see it?
I wish I was there, man.
What screening were you at?
I was at the Sarasota Film Festival screening. Okay. I think it was maybe a Wednesday or Thursday evening.
I wasn't able to make it to that one, but we do have nurses in attendance at all our screenings, as many as we can, our screenings, and we hand out replicas. So what you had is an actual replica of the original life insurance policy.
Absolutely, and this worked. I mean, this
it completely
this
worked. It was a smash hit, and of course, it got picked up by Allied Artists, and it was ended up being distributed, and Castle made a fortune. He really did make a fortune. And he bet. He was a betting man, and he convinced his wife to let him mortgage the house, and she stood by him, and they did this film. But then he had to top that, so the next film was House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price, and he came up with an even more outrageous gimmick, which was called Emergo. And Emergo was a skeleton, a plastic rubber skeleton on a wire that would come out from behind the screen at a pivotal moment in the film and kind of dangle over the audience and then and then you go back behind the screen again. And the kids who saw that movie, that was also a sensation because every kid in America had to go see that movie. I mean, wouldn't you? You'd have to go see the movie where the skeleton comes out. And,
absolutely. And, you know, what's so great about the movie, too, is, it really paints a portrait of this guy, which I said in the intro, is like an extinct breed. I mean, he was a true showman. And plus it makes you wistful for that kind of more innocent time.
Absolutely. You know? He also was sort of like it was sort of like the circus was coming to town because his films didn't open up wide the way they do today. They opened up by territory. So he would open the movie in one city. He would come to the city, would make a personal appearance. The ad campaign would be tailored for that city. The local movie theater would get involved in the exploitation of the picture. You know, the ushers would be walking around town with placards and dressed up in crazy costumes. And then maybe if you're lucky, Castle himself would come to town too. And then he would pack up the whole show and go to the next town. So he really made you feel as if you know, your town was the center of the universe. And we don't have that kind of setup anymore. I mean, everything is corporate, and they will just blanket the country with the same ad campaign. It's not tailored toward particular regions. And also, it was much more of a communal experience. I think now our movie-going experiences are becoming much more solitary. And film festivals are great exception to that, but what Castle was doing really, I think it was really fostered community in these towns. And you just ask any kid who grew up at that time. I mean, these memories are just imprinted on their DNA. I mean, the audiences that we get for Spine Tingler, there's a lot of former members of the William Castle fan club who are grown up who remember. They can tell you exactly where they were, what day they saw the Tingler, what they were wearing.
Wow.
I mean, it's incredible. And so I'm finding a lot of movie fans, real true movie fans from way back, are coming out for this movie.
They are. And many were there that night, too. And it was kind of a return to the different time in their lives, too.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
And, he was such a showman, and these different ideas like Percepto and Illusiono and Emerge, you know, as long as it ended with an O, I think someone in your film said it was a definite gimmick that he tried.
Give me your money, O. John Waters said that, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. I want to play this other clip and introduce a whole new topic into here with the Castle, the parallels between Castle and Hitchcock. So if we can listen to this real quick.
Bill was very aware and very much in awe of Alfred Hitchcock, his idol, the man he called the master.
I believe William Castle spent his whole life really being jealous of Hitchcock. I think he wanted to be him.
Bill's competitive nature was such that whatever he saw Hitchcock doing, Bill said, I can do better.
Hitchcock was making really good films. And Dad is making B films.
Well, I've cleaned all this up now. Big difference. You should have seen the blood.
Hitch was always very dry. Bill Castle was much more a carny barker.
I'm William Castle, and this wheelchair is just to rest my tired nerves after producing a picture like this one.
He was the low rent Hitchcock, and I mean that with great respect. He was more fun than Hitchcock. I mean, Hitchcock only had one suit. Hitchcock was the class act, certainly. William Castle was his poor cousin.
That's John Waters. He's very colorful in the movie too.
Oh yes.
Tell me about this this parallel. I mean, Hitchcock was William Castle obviously became a brand name, much like Hitchcock did for his films. But was there a jealousy at play here for Castle?
Some have theorized that there is a jealousy there. I think that obviously Hitchcock didn't have anything to worry about with competition with William Castle, but, you know, Hitchcock was one of those handful of directors in the 50s and 60s who turned themselves into a brand name and an icon. Disney did that, Preminger did that, Cecil B. DeMille even earlier did that. And there were kids growing up didn't really think about directors so much,
right.
And nor did the public. It was you just go see the movie, and people were more interested in the stars. But Hitchcock was able to turn himself into a caricature, and that was mostly because of the TV show that and also appearing in his trailers. And
right.
Castle saw that and certainly was inspired by that. If you look at Castle starting to introduce his own films or appearing in the trailers and narrating them, appearing in the ads. But what was interesting is Hitchcock was making very high-budget, glossy studio movies with big stars. Castle certainly wasn't doing that. He was making low-budget, black-and-white shockers that made a lot of money. And Hitchcock saw that Castle was doing that and decided to work in that genre, to make a low-budget, black-and-white shocker, which was Psycho. And that was certainly inspired by the success that William Castle was having, and other filmmakers too, but especially William Castle. So when Psycho came out, Castle was kind of flabbergasted when he saw that Hitchcock was doing a gimmick. And he had a gimmick for Psycho, which was that you weren't allowed to enter the theater after the movie started. And that was a revolutionary idea for that time, because people would just sort of come and go during the movie. You'd come in halfway into the movie, and then you'd see the end, and then you'd sit there and watch the beginning again, and then leave halfway through the next screening. But that was forbidden, which really actually did cause a sensation. So Hitchcock was doing a Castle-esque kind of gimmick. And then, of course, after Psycho was a smash hit, William Castle made Homicidal, which was some call a ripoff, some call an homage. I call it a little of both. It's a fantastic movie. I'm sure you guys have seen it. If you haven't, run out and see Homicidal. It's great. And it also has a transgender murder theme going on in it. And it's definitely written with and directed with Psycho in mind. So it's a lot.
I haven't seen it. I got to see it now.
Oh, you haven't seen it? Oh, I hope I didn't ruin the ending for you, but I think...
No. That sounds like a great time.
It's great. It's a lot of fun.
It was always interesting to me with Psycho is that he even admitted that. He said, you know, this movie became so popular, but this is my B-movie. I used all my TV people as my crew, and you know, he always considered it his B-movie.
Absolutely. It was a low-budget shocker, and it was very distasteful. It was considered beneath him that he was doing that. And,
that's right.
You know, it had a toilet in it. It was the first toilet in a movie, you know. People forget that movie really... caused a sensation because it was dealing with some really forbidden, taboo subject matter. The guy dressing up as
mother.
I mean, that's kind of stuff was just not done. And so certainly, Castle and Hitchcock knew each other. There's a wonderful photo of them together. I don't know this for a fact, but I think Hitchcock got a kick out of Castle, and Castle certainly, was inspired by Hitchcock, but. As John Waters says in our film, that Castle was a lot more fun than Hitchcock, because Hitchcock only had one suit.
Yeah, and it brings up an interesting point. Say that Castle had directed Psycho instead of Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been received in the same light?
Well, that's a good question. I think the interesting question maybe is if Castle would have directed Rosemary's Baby. Because that actually was a possibility. Because when Castle was looking for a film to do to prove to the industry and the public that he could make a movie as good as a Hitchcock film, and he wanted that to be Rosemary's Baby. He actually got the rights to it before anyone else had them, and he intended to direct it. And then when he brought the rights to Robert Evans at Paramount, Robert Evans wanted to produce it, but he wouldn't let him direct the movie. So Castle had to decide whether he wanted to move forward with that, and he did because he knew it was a great property, and he was going to get to work with Polanski, who was unproven really at that time as far as a Hollywood movie.
Right.
And they made together, I really feel they made this brilliant movie, but you have to wonder what it would have been like, what kind of movie it would have been if Castle had directed it. I know it certainly wouldn't have been the masterpiece.
It certainly bears Polanski's stamp. I mean, it's undeniable. That was one of the highlights of the documentary to me, is the account of Rosemary's Baby, because I'm such a fan of that movie. But it's interesting because it proved, kind of in a way, to be Castle's salvation because he always wanted to be taken seriously, but also it kind of marked a downfall for him as well.
Right, right. It's true. He it was a gigantic hit, and it was it made him a, he was doing well before, but it made him a very rich man. And but it didn't result in more A pictures for him. It actually, he got sick right during and after that film came out. He almost died. There were a bunch of tragedies that occurred that some say were the result of a curse that was put on that movie. I mean, Castle certainly played up that angle. Roman Polanski, of course, the Sharon Tate murders happened, and the composer of the movie died of an aneurysm suddenly, and Castle also had these horrible health problems. So he was never really able to regain his footing after Rosemary's Baby, and he was under contract still to Paramount, and the next movie they gave him was a movie that was called Project X, which nobody's seen and nobody remembers. It was a low-budget sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
And it was actually very poignant and sad because he was also getting older, and this was a time, as you know, in the late 60s and when the younger generation was taking over, and he was considered over the hill at that
point.
And so our final act of the movie is very bittersweet, you know. Because
yeah, I think so too. I found it that way too.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic movie. Tell me what the plans are for it. I mean, it's been screening at film festivals across the country. Has it found a distributor?
It's going to continue on the festival circuit. We're actually playing this week in Newport Beach, California, and we're going to be in Baltimore next weekend, and there's a whole bunch of other festivals over the next few months. It'll continue on the circuit. Usually the life of these things on a festival circuit is about a year. So we premiered it back in November here in Los Angeles. It'll probably keep going on the circuit at least till then. And we're looking for distribution right now. We have we're doing all the things that indie filmmakers do to try to get the thing sold. So that's where we're at right now, and I'm sure that will happen because everyone is asking me about, you know, when can I get a DVD, and ultimately that will happen. But I can't give you a date. I don't know yet.
Well, once you do, please come back and join us because I'm crazy about the movie. It's called Spine Tingler, The William Castle Story. It's just a great documentary for anyone that loves films or anyone that wants to be transported even to a more innocent time. I mean, it's a very moving experience and fun. And I appreciate you being on our show so much, Jeffrey.
Oh, sure.
Thank
I really
you
enjoyed
so
it. You guys know what you're talking about.
Thank you. Really. It was an honor.
Well, thank you so much, Jeffrey, and please feel free to call us back anytime you want.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's Jeffrey Schwarz. The movie is Spine Tingler, The William Castle Story. It's a great documentary.
It sounds like a wonderful documentary.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't have those P.T. Barnum of movies anymore, you know,
No, we don't. We really don't.
We're missing a lot of the fun. I mean, we probably live in times that are too cynical to allow for that now, you know. But.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're absolutely cynical being the key word, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Aaron.
What's up, fellas?
Hey, how are you, Aaron? Welcome back.
Thanks a lot. Speaking of William Castle, I think one of the greatest tributes to William Castle is the Joe Dante film Matinee.
You're right.
Yeah.
Just one of probably Dante's unsung masterpiece. I mean, I love Gremlins. I think that's a great film, but Matinee is just a marvelous.
It's a very
underseen film.
It's a very nice film. It's a very charming little movie.
And John Goodman does a killer William Castle kind of impersonation.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
That's a great film. If anyone wants to really get if they can't get it as a documentary, they want to get a sense, even though it's not a William Castle story or biopic, they want to get a sense of what Castle kind
of. Yeah, it's done in the spirit
of
his legacy.
Yeah.
We should rent Matinee because who among us wouldn't want to see the movie Mant for real?
Exactly.
I would see
exactly. That. It's a great movie. You should look it up if it comes to your town and anyone out there. We're going to talk about DVDs.
Yep.
But first, I want to open it up. Just tell us a little bit about, because we announced a couple of weeks ago on the show what you were embarking on. You're embarking on this very special honor, this very special distinction you have. You've just been a great week in New York. Tell us about it.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I was at the second annual Museum of the Moving Image Institute on Film Criticism and Feature Writing. Is sponsored by the New York Times. This is the second one. He did one last year, and then did it this year. And it was 5 days you spent at the museum, you know, basically from 9 a.m. to about 6 p.m. every day. And there was 12 of us, of all the applicants, there were 13 of us, film journalists and critics, mostly this year from what I'm from the Internet. There were a couple people who had some print, had work in print. One guy, Stephen Becker, was the movies editor for the Dallas Morning News, but he's also going into the Internet a little with the newspaper, and this editor of this wonderful magazine called After Image, named Karen Van Meeren. So she does in print, but everyone had a blog. Everyone is mostly published on the Internet. They do it for the love of film, and they really want to hone the craft of film criticism, and that's what this was about. And it really became a kind of a crossroads discussion on the future of film criticism.
Yeah.
As you know, a lot of critics have been taking buyouts, or they've just been downsized out of work. So where is the state of film criticism as a profession, along with now that the Internet is not going anywhere, what does film criticism mean on that medium, that media delivery service of the Internet, and is there a way to make it a profession, or is it now just going to be done just out of the pure love of it?
A hobby.
That's the million-dollar question.
And for all of us, me included, you know, it's funny you say the word hobby, because obviously in the new issue of the New York Press, Armand White.
We were talking about that.
Pretty much labeled everyone on the Internet as just doing it as a hobby. And he uses the word Internetters kind of interchangeably, meaning, you know, critics, bloggers, people who run sites like Anacrone
right.
News and Chud, as if they're kind of all one and the same, which is kind of the problem that traditional media has about new media. They're very skeptical and very territorial, and they don't want to take the time out to find that there is distinction between all of that. And yes, I guess technically you could call this kind of a hobby, but I think I can speak for us in that, yes, we're doing this, as you could say, free, but
right.
that's not because we don't want to parlay this into something professional. But
right,
right.
I mean, but I know that that's like a dirty word. I don't really consider it a dirty word. I mean, when I get paid to do this for a living, it'll be my job.
Yeah.
But right now it's my hobby, but it's all encompassing. I mean, it's all consuming.
Right.
It's not to say that I take this lightly or I don't think there's any art or value to this.
It's right. one thing I like to do. It's one of many things I like to do, but I don't really consider it a hobby. I understand where White's coming from in that regard, but the way he lumps everything together,
But it does sound like a dismissive word. I mean,
he's very dismissive.
Well, and like I said, the way he kind of...
I'm sorry, that's just my opinion. I just think...
No, you're entitled to it, yeah.
And the way, like I said, he, you know, lumps in, you know, we're critics, and there's a difference between us, and then there's a difference between people who just blog about film, and then there's people who, like I said, Anacrone News and Chud and those types of sites. Those are not the same as what we do. I mean, it's all totally different, all total different mindsets. And in the end, I really don't want to be known as an Internet critic. I just would like to be known as a film critic.
Right.
And I think because a lot of us at the Institute feel, you know, hey, we will do it any way, you know, we're allowed to.
You know, it goes back to a conversation that we have a lot of times in the other the job that I
right.
have,
yeah.
which is a marketing position. Mm-hmm. And we're always confronted with the idea where newspapers are becoming less and less prevalent.
Yeah,
I mean, you know.
But will there ever be a time when we don't have newspapers? And even every newspaper, even this from the small town newspapers to the larger ones, I mean, they have comprehensive websites. They're really invested
yeah.
in the web now. But there's something tactile about getting that morning paper that a lot of people aren't going to want to give up.
Yeah, I don't want to give it up, but it sounds like they're.
I am in that category. I'm kind of. I will say this. I'm kind of in against the grain of my generation in that, you know, everyone is all about digital and online. I still want something tangible, be it a newspaper, be it an actual CD
or a magazine. Yeah,
magazine. I still feel that. But also, like I said, you know, if we could do this show, you know, on a, you know, on a NPR type of scale where it's, you know, fun, we would, you know, I think we would jump at that because that would mean even more listeners, you know.
Right.
But
that would be our dream.
That would be our dream. But we're doing it
NPR, XM, satellite, whatever.
That would be our dream. Same thing with me as I write online. I've only written stuff online that's been public. That doesn't mean I'm doing it just because I prefer internet over print. It's just that the internet has afforded me the opportunity.
It's easier
to get my voice out and to get work done. And but you know, I do not, you know, so the one thing I think a lot of us at the Institute would agree, you know, we want to be film taken seriously as film critics and not separated as internet critics or internet journalists or and so forth. And I think
You made the news. You made the news, and we actually posted it up on our blogs.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware, you're in the IndieWire IndieWire news feed.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. One of our buddies made the news. So
yeah, one of the guys at IndieWire was there. A lot of people. In fact, one of the freelancers for the New York Press was in the Institute. Fine film critic named Eric Cohn. Young guy, very vital writer, a very smart writer. He's
a good voice to work in parallel to Armand White.
He's kind of in contrast to Armand. The calm at the New York Press. Eric Cohn is one of the finest new young talent. In fact, all the writers who were there were just I just want to name a couple: Cynthia Fuchs, Jet Murnian, Kevin Lee, Doug Cummings, David Kippen, and there's a bunch more. They were just Karen Van Meeren. They're all wonderful writers, and they really should be taken care of because this is the new. I feel this will bring about a new wave of film criticism, and they're smart critics. They're smart people.
And it's just like everything else. It's just like Blog Talk Radio too. I think that the cream rises to the crop, rises to the top.
Yeah, like the crop.
You know, you're gonna have a lot of, you know, Joe Schmoes that write about film in a not so deep way.
I mean, let's look at it this way. This is a very simplistic way to put it. Rex Reed has been writing since the 60s. So there's always going to be a Rex Reed. There's always going to be a Gene Shalit. They're always going to be there. It's nothing new with this, you know, you got to take this with all the other series.
Right.
You know. So, but other than, you know, but it was a fun, it was a really stimulating institute. I met a lot of great people I know that we're going to come in contact soon. And not
filmmakers.
Only,
filmmakers,
not only the critics, but filmmakers who have just been real receptive and who are these are filmmakers who want to learn about film journalism online and are open to it.
Right.
Tom Kalem and Kelly Richard, Tom Kalem of Swoon and Savage Great, Kelly Richard of the great little scene Old Joy, which is a fine...
That's a good movie. That's a very fine film.
She has a new film that's going to be a can. Ellen Kuras, a world-class cinematographer who's now making her directorial debut as a documentarian with great... She showed us bits of a film that are of her documentary that are just fabulous. And like I said, she's one of the great cinematographers working today.
Yeah, she shot Shine a Light.
She's part of the Shine a Light crew, Summer of Sam, Bamboozled.
Yeah.
She's on the new Sam Mendes film. She's done all of Michelle Gondry's films. Blow, which is a technically marvelous-looking movie. She's just a world class. Her and Paris Savides are pretty much the head and shoulders above everyone else.
Right, now you're right.
And then we met some of the old guard who also are open to the internet, who were curious and want to learn more about it. Met Andrew Saris and Molly Haskell, and they were just fascinated about this new avenue of criticism. Andrew Saris pretty much said, he guess that the students in his class, he teaches at Columbia, he says, my students write better film criticism and are better writers than I was at that age back in the 40s and 50s.
Which is really something because Andrew Saris, you know, we mentioned him earlier in the Pauline Kael realm.
Yeah.
He's one of the old schoolers. So for him to embrace, you know, the future possibilities, that's really something. That's very refreshing.
So there it was just wonderful people and a wonderful dessert. We talk about DVDs, some DVD people. Don Krim of Kino. It's just he was truly open to the internet and about Blu-ray and so forth. And he's just wonderful. And I've been in contact with him. And there's just a lot of great possibilities. And
well, it ended well too. I mean, you haven't named the elephant in the room there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the finale of your trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. You talking about talking about Michael Barker? And,
I'm talking about Arthur Penn.
Oh, Arthur,
I'm talking
yeah,
about the big dog.
Arthur Penn was there. Arthur Penn was amazing. Obviously, he talked a lot about Bonnie and Clyde, which is, you know, terrific. But I asked him a couple more off-the-beaten-path questions because my theory being that, you know, even I'm sure even Orson Welles got tired of talking about Citizen Kane once in a while.
Right.
So I talked to him about Miracle Worker, and I even asked him about Four Friends, a little scene film from late 81. And it's interesting. I asked him about Four Friends because, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and Alice's Restaurant were two Arthur Penn films from the 60s, and they seemed to be about the 60s at the moment. And Four Friends, coincidentally, is probably the first film to actually take a look back at the 60s and try to make sense of it. And he seemed pretty cognizant of that, Four Friends, which is a forgotten film, and it's a fine piece of personal writing, and that Four Friends is not totally sentimental, and is actually trying to come to grips with the 60s, which is when the film was made, was only about 11 years old, so Four Friends is an important film, and he was moved that I asked about it. Afterwards, you know, everyone was leaving, and he was leaving the room. He came up to me, and I went up to him to shake his hand, and he came up to me, and he leaned into me, and he said, "I want to thank you for asking about Four Friends. I really share your enthusiasm for it."
Yeah.
So, you know, I doubt many people ask him Four Friends questions, but, I mean, I certainly did. And I was going to ask him about Night Moves and see if he could explain the ending, but I ran out of time. But I will say that I brought up Michael Barker because I was on the final day also. We went to Sony Pictures Classics, and we saw a movie called The Whackness, which I'm
right.
sure we're going to be probably doing something with. Hopefully we'll do something, because Michael Barker, he was very open. He goes, "I understand about this new internet with the websites and all of this." He goes, "But I don't know, you know," he goes, "I want to know more." And we told him, "We'll go to these sites." And I said, "You know, I'm a Blog Talk Radio." And he's like, "Well, that's interesting." He goes, he said something. He goes, "What is that?" And I told him, I go, "Well, it's a internet radio show." I go, "It's on the air and it's live, but it's also archived on iTunes. And so it's, you know, we had over 100,000 listeners. We've been on a year. We grow every month with listeners and popularity. We've had directors." I said, "You know, Schrader and Badhams and so forth." And, you know, the neat thing is that the person can call from anywhere. They don't have to be in a studio. They don't have to be, you know, at their home. They can call anywhere with the phone as long as we know their number, and we can interview them for as long as they want, and it's just off the cuff, and they can say whatever they want.
You know, we're really doing this at the right time. I think we're on the cusp or something. And, our anniversary show, Aaron, I don't know if you listened to it yet, but we had people call from all over the place and tell us their favorite interviews. We really had – it was an eye-opening experience.
Yes, it was.
Because we don't know who's out there listening. I got an email just yesterday. Chris Keene, the author that we spoke to Sunday, Jerry, he wrote us and said, "Man, I had a great time. You guys know what you're talking about. It was a funny interview. I had a ball. Now I know why everyone's talking about you." I'm like, "Everybody's talking about us?"
Who?
You know, that's what I want to know, but I had no idea, you know?
When I told Barker about this, I heard him mutter to himself. He goes, "Wow, that sounds something like Errol Morris might be interested in doing."
Yeah.
Hey,
we'd love to have Errol Morris.
Like, "Hey, Errol Morris can call anytime."
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We get Errol Morris, man. That's it. That we can stop the show after that, after Errol Morris.
Well, maybe you can, but I still got Pacino to work on that.
Yeah.
Let's get to some talk about DVDs, including one of the most anticipated movies in the while that was released in January. It's just making its way to DVD, Cloverfield.
All right, I have two picks, and I'll go through them real quick. Obviously, one is Cloverfield, which is just coming out on DVD, and which, despite the blurb on the DVD that says a landmark, a milestone, quote, "Harry Knowles ain't any cool news," I will not go that far.
Right. But it's a lot of fun.
Cloverfield is a lot of fun, and it does say something. It is a film that should be studied in terms of its audience awareness and of its marketing. And unlike The Blair Witch, which I do still think is probably still the best of these types of found footage films to be made, it is something. Cloverfield is interesting, which I do think is a fine, small-scale B-movie, But it does pose an interesting question in that, was the movie even relevant? It seemed like Cloverfield really indicated a real moment in film culture, in that where all the buzz and advertising around it were kind of, that was, to some people, I'm sure that was more entertaining than the film, and the film mm-hmm. was kind of an afterthought. But if you
that's the risk of all of these.
That's the risk, but I think actually the film was, you know, I did keep up with a lot of the campaigns online, but I got to say the finished product I remember more than any of the advertising that went into it, with the exception of the trailer in front of Transformers, which still has to be one of the greatest stealing thunder I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It does hold up. I mean, there are scenes that are quite, and obviously everyone knows about the Statue of Liberty head rolling down.
Well, I think the scene on the Brooklyn Bridge is absolutely frightening.
The Brooklyn Bridge scene. And then I actually love the final sequence of when they're in the helicopter
yeah.
in daylight.
Yeah.
We finally get a you know, a clear view of what this thing looks like. That's a great moment. And another really great sequence.
Yelling in the theater, get away from that thing.
Yeah. And another great sequence that is really, really good that probably owes the most to Blair Witch is the walking in the subway at Pitch Blackness, which is
that, yeah, that's a good, but that's a great. There are a lot of great sequences, I think, in
yeah.
the film.
And I will say, in defense of the characterizations in the film, I think Cloverfield might be the first film. Everyone always talks about interactive movies and, you know, these video game movies that have pretty much failed, but Cloverfield might be the first truly interactive movie in that. The characters, and I do not take away anything from the actors who actually give fine performances,
mm-hmm.
but the characters are so paper thin that they really are superfluous, and like the real star of Cloverfield is you, the viewer. You
right.
are the one holding the camcorder. You
mm-hmm.
are the one this is happening to. And so really...
I think that's an excellent point, actually, and the one that I haven't really heard made before. Yeah.
That's,
Cloverfield.
So that's
and, you know,
star,
in spite of all the buzz and everything, I mean,
yeah.
this for me, and I think you guys are speaking in agreement, this wasn't a movie that suffered from it. And on a second viewing, it still holds up because it's just effective.
It is very effective.
The movie works.
Yeah.
Know?
And they say the movie does work. And like I said, I do think it isn't. I think it is the first truly interactive motion picture. Now, some critics have you know, kind of bemoan that because, you know, they don't want, you know, because it is true, you want movies to act upon you. You don't want to interact with a film. That's a totally different experience. But as an isolated incident, which I think Cloverfield
yeah.
is, it
yeah.
is an exception. It's not going to, I don't think it's going to be a long, long, long time before a movie like Cloverfield becomes a norm, and it probably never will, actually.
I hope it doesn't.
It does work on its own terms.
Yes,
however, that being said, Cloverfield 2, I think, is a mistake.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen as quick as everyone thought.
Well, however quickly it happens, it's on the
roster. I don't think people are signed for it.
I don't think
it'll happen. And if it does happen, I don't have any inside information, but I can almost guarantee you, like Open Water 2, it'll be straight to DVD. I just don't see it. Lightning.
That's a good point. I never even saw the sequel to Open Water, so I don't.
I must say,
well, we might be welcoming Michael Stahl-David on the show in the next few weeks. So
I think Open Water is a wonderful film, and especially when you stay for those credits. Wow.
Is he in Open Water too, or Open Water? Michael Stahl-David?
No. He was the star of Cloverfield. So maybe
he
has some information.
Is he?
Well, I don't know if he's going to tell us anything.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to tell us anything.
But what comes on the
should
what's
I not ask
DVD?
Then?
What's on the DVD, Aaron?
Well, it's the usual bells and whistles of featurettes. You know how they created the creature. There's a commentary by the director Matt Reeves. Oddly enough, J.J. Abrams is not on the commentary. I would have thought it would have been a joint commentary, but that's not the case. And so it's a fine pack. I find what is interesting, you know, we're talking about marketing here, is that there are different iterations of the DVD at different outlets. Best Buy, you get the Best Buy version, you get a disc of 30 minutes of...
I got yesterday. I haven't watched it yet.
The diary, basically the 30-minute diary of the character in the camcorder.
Yeah.
You get that. I can't remember. I think it's Target. but don't quote me, I lost track of this. I think Target actually has a CD of the music supposedly played at the party in the opening 20 minutes. So you'll get the mixtape, if you will, that was going to be played at the party.
Right, okay.
So, you know, so these all
see, I have to be honest about this. I don't like that. I don't like the specially packaged things for different vendors. You should make the one package available for everyone, so you don't have to buy multiple copies. I put it akin to releasing a special edition, you know, 6 months after you release the bare bones edition. I mean, it's just
I understand that.
In principle, I guess I probably agree with you, but I think on this one, since it's all different modes of bonuses. I mean, one's a DVD with special features, one's a CD with music. So it's not like this one has a DVD of features and this one has another DVD of features. They're two separate modes of bonuses. So I think they're smart in like really separating it.
Manolo does this. Manolo, like, I don't know, we're not talking about movies with Manolo, but Manolo releases a CD, and he'll have different songs available in different versions for different vendors, and it's just distasteful to me. It's like a very obvious money-grubbing kind of scheme to me.
Yeah.
Am I the only one?
I know.
Yeah, because when I think Manolo, I think distasteful money-grubbing scheme, but that's another story. That's another editorial.
That's the only time you'll ever see Menlo referenced with Cloverfield, by the way.
I hope that's the only time we see Menlo referenced with Movie Geeks United. But I don't know.
No, it's not happening. As long as I'm the co-host.
You're starting a war there, Aaron.
I know. Are we ever going to get Menlo on the show?
I'm trying, man. But the problem is our show is called Movie Geeks United.
I know, but Billy Joel was on Inside the Actors Studio, so
there's something to that. I mean, I'm trying to work my way into, you know, he doesn't have a bigger fan.
Yeah.
So Cloverfield is a definite recommend, I would think.
It is a definite recommend. It is Cloverfield is what it is, and for that it is recommend. I do recommend it.
The other disc I want to
could highlight real quick because it's a wonderful box set and I got it in a few weeks ago and I've been slowly going through it. I haven't even finished it. It's this Classic Musicals Volume 2 came from Warner Brothers and it's just wonderful and I want to highlight just one title and that's the DVD release of Classical Musicals from the Dream Factory. Volume 3. So it's just wonderful. And I want to highlight Hit the Deck from 1955, which is one of the many great sailor musicals, you know, following in, you could say, Anchors Away and On the Town. And then there's Hit the Deck, and it's great, great, just a great musical with Tony Martin, Vic Damone, Russ Tamblyn as the three male leads, and the female leads are Jane Powell, Debbie Reynolds, and Ann Miller. And like the other, like Anchors Away and On the Town, they're just three sailors on leave for a weekend, and they meet some girls, and they flirt, and they dance, and they fall in love, and it's just a bunch of Vincent Yeoman tunes. And it's just terrific. And the highlight is Ann Miller's. Ann Miller's doing The Lady from the Bayou. And that's just a show-stopping number. And this whole box set is just a wonderful collection of these musicals that I'm sure would probably, separately, they probably wouldn't get much movement. But in this nice box set, you really get your money's worth. And every disc comes with features, be it isolated remastered scores, which, you know, they've gone back and done 5.1 or 5.0 remasterings, music-only scores, outtake tunes. And it is really cool. Every one of them comes with a short and a cartoon that is related to these musicals. And it's just a wonderful box set.
Is that available now?
That is available now, called Classic Musicals from the Dream Factory. And I'm highlighting Hit the Deck, but there's not a dud in here. The other ones are Deep in My Heart, Kismet, Nancy Goes to Rio, 2 Weeks with Love, and here, Broadway Melody of 1936, Broadway Melody of 1938, which are just, you know, staples.
Classic, yeah.
And Born to Dance and Lady Be Good. And they're just, you know, it's just terrific stuff.
Man, that's really what musicals ruled the...
That's, yeah,
yeah,
it is.
I mean, this Hit the Deck is 1955, and so you could say, I mean, that's really kind of, the slow waning of it. I mean, we're still going to get some big musicals, you know, Carousel and Oklahoma, you know, but that was, you know, when we started getting those, it was like, you know, it was going to be the one, two big musicals, big productions a year, you know, and this is where they were still cranking them out at this early, mid-50s period, and they're still cranking them out. But it was slowly coming to an end. Obviously, TV was coming into its own. And so, you know, Hollywood was going to be kind of in a, you could say,
a funk.
Yeah, a funk.
You know,
or, you know, as we talked with Mark Harris, you know, for a few years, Hollywood really was kind of lost. Late, you know, from, you know, probably from, you know, 59 till about, you know, to 67, really, basically. I mean, obviously, you had great stuff in between that, but... It wasn't, you know, it was still kind of a no man's land.
Right.
But this box set is just wonderful. Like I said, classic musicals from the Dream Factory, Volume 3. One of the highlights.
What do you think is the, in a different topic, so this is another definite recommend. It's available
it's
now
on DVD. Box. You can get these separately, Hit the Deck. They're also separately, all these musicals I said, but I recommend the box because it's truly worth every penny.
What do you think is the quintessential movie musical?
Oof. I guess traditional musical. I guess I would have to. I'm gonna be someone who's obvious and go probably with Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
But in the new style musical, and I do consider stuff made after 1962 musicals. I'm gonna go. Probably one of my favorites is actually Saturday Night Fever, which is a musical. You know, a lot of people say it's not a musical.
Right.
Right. Singing. But the form of it is a music, is of a musical. In fact, to me,
but,
Saturday Night
just,
Fever.
But just the, I would have to go Singing in the Rain too.
Yeah.
But it's an astounding experience, and the movie is pure bliss.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, and when you see people dance, when you see these giants dance, it's Gene Kelly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, it is bliss.
It is,
nope.
And I want to say I've never bought into the old theory, you know, this came out, you know, a few years ago when Chicago won Best Picture, of the musicals, you know, were dead and now they've been reborn. Musicals have always been with us, even when they were supposedly dead. They just changed their form. Saturday Night Fever was not your traditional musical, neither, you know, but it was
all that jazz. All that jazz was
all
really
all that
yeah.
jazz.
Yeah.
Purple Rain is a
musical. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a musical. Even, you know, Flashdance is a musical. Even something, you know, you're going to laugh, but House Party is a musical. And it's a terrific musical. And last year in particular should be noted was the year of the musical. Not only did you have traditional stuff like Hairspray and Sweeney Todd, but you had off-Broadway kind of stuff like Once, Across the Universe, and Walk Hard, Romance and Cigarettes, which was my favorite, Control about Joy Division.
Yeah, there are a lot of great ones.
I mean, there was not a dud when it came to musicals last year. It was truly the year of the musical last year.
Definite change in tone, though. Actually, Hairspray has a lot of the tone of the older musicals. It just the approach is.
Well, both Hairspray and Sweeney Todd...
More risk-taking, obviously.
You know, both Hairspray and Sweeney Todd come from the stage, and so they have that traditional structure. But then stuff
Sweeney
broke out
Todd
of it.
Sweeney Todd is brilliant.
Yeah, and I'm actually... I tell you, the film I think is going to be... that's under the radar this summer that I'm really looking forward to is Mamma Mia.
Yeah, well, it looks good.
Yeah.
I saw a trailer for it a while ago. It looks good.
So I think that'll be a surprise hit. And that's always the other thing. Whenever these musicals come out and they become... a hit, be it Once or Across the Universe, it's always, wow, surprise hit musical. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise.
It
shouldn't be a surprise.
And plus it offers a different experience, you know, and we're definitely not overloaded with that genre of movie, so when we get one, I mean, and it's worth seeing, I mean, people jump at it because it's a different experience than anything else available at the multiplex. I talked earlier about the BBC Natural History DVD collection.
Right.
It's phenomenal. And there's great artistry in this collection, and Planet Earth is probably the highest profile title in the box set. But it also includes, let me look here, it also includes titles like The Blue Planet, comprehensive, I think that one alone is four discs, of the underwater life, the life of mammals, the life of birds. I mean, if you're, you know, it's fascinating stuff, but it's not, it's just the artistry that goes into the, and the photography,
oh,
and
mm-hmm.
it's just orgasmic. I mean, it really is, and I cannot recommend it enough, especially if you're into this sort of thing anyway that you see on the Discovery Channel, that kind of programming. But even beyond that, just the technical wizardry behind capturing
these
images.
It should be noted that this year, I mean, actually, I think it was this week or late last week, it was announced that, I guess, the probably inspired partially by the success of the Penguins film from
right.
2 years ago, but also Planet Earth and all these other things, that Disney has launched Disney Nature, which they will be releasing, I think it was, I can't remember if it was 6 or 8, you know, feature films into theaters, you know, involving
you just nature. Don't, it's just breathtaking, and it's all around us, you know, and these things are so eye-opening, mm-hmm. all the different species and all the different behaviors of these species, and it's just extraordinary, and it's life that surrounds you. I mean, it's not any kind of foreign thing, and this is like 2,022 minutes of footage included in this entire box set. I mean, it's as comprehensive as you can get.
I will say the one film that gets, because, you know, they always talk about how, they talk about the penguins and how that kind of brought this stuff back. And it always seemed like every couple of years there was always a nature film that kind of struck a chord.
Microcosmos,
I was going to get to that. Microcosmos is a probably a forgotten film, which is a remarkable nature film. Probably, it's still probably my favorite. And I remember, I wasn't that big a fan, but I remember back in, I think it was 88 or 89, anyone remember The Bear?
Oh, The Bear. Now, The Bear is actually a superb film. I'd actually say one of that director's best films, almost as good as Quest for Fire.
Yeah, The Bear is another one. And who here doesn't love Benji the Hunted?
I like For the Love of Benji. That was the last one I remember.
Benji
I didn't see Benji the Hunted. But
can we all agree it was better than Full Metal Jacket? Or is that just you?
Wow. I like that comparison. It is amazing stuff.
If any of our listeners don't know, there's a famous Siskel and Ebert episode where on the same show they reviewed Full Metal Jacket and Benji the Hunted, and Ebert gave thumbs down to one of them. I'll just leave it at that.
Right.
You can figure out which one he gave thumbs down to.
Wow.
Yeah, it's extraordinary stuff. And like I said, these are unsung heroes, the photographers and the filmmakers that capture this footage.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to have the opportunity to speak to some of them in future episodes, because of enormous talent and images that they capture.
And enormous patience.
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be. This is probably some of the most dedicated filmmakers working, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So, Aaron, another great time for DVDs. Anything exciting on the horizon, like future releases that we should be on the lookout for?
Well, I'll give you one feature and one TV. Feature, I think we're going to be covering this, hopefully in a little bit of detail. I'm excited. Is the Lionsgate box complete Rambo?
Yeah.
Which I'm just very excited.
We will definitely be covering that.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. There's other good stuff, you know, there's Sinatra and Dirty Harry's coming up, but I got to admit the Rambo thing is really exciting. And as for television, there is one title I do want to highlight, because new season will be starting later this summer, and that is, and I didn't get to finish seeing the season last year, and I'll look forward to it, is Rescue Me.
Yeah, me too. The same here. I didn't get to watch all of it either.
So those are two that are one TV, one film, and hopefully we'll be highlighting those. And there's a bunch of other titles. You know, the summer, summer is usually kind of a lull in DVDs, because it's usually the stuff that come out theatrically.
Right.
The beginning of the year is coming out in the summer, so there's kind of a lull.
Right.
But I think there's going to be some good catalog stuff,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be coming out that's really going to fill that void. So we'll be covering up a lot more stuff. So Rambo coming soon.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Yes.
My friends, thank you for another great show. We're going to get to the bottom of the guests that we weren't able to bring on, and hopefully bring them on in a future episode. Join us Sunday night, where we'll be talking movies as usual and interviewing author Richard Pepperman. He's got a great book. He's got a book about how DVDs and how they're kind of a substitute for film school now.
Right.
Whether right or wrong. You know, the promise of DVDs, a great educational tool. He takes, like, many DVDs, and he goes by the minute and the second and the chapter listing, and he says, you know, this is the lesson to be learned from this scene and the verdict, you know, and it's fascinating. It's a great book, actually something that's right up your alley too, Aaron. And so that's Sunday's show, and we appreciate everyone out there listening in the chat room, and we will see you next time.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
If you want to make an impact online, GoDaddy.com is the place to be. Domain names starting at $1.99 and complete web packages at unbeatably low prices. Best of all, if you enter the code MovieGeeks upon checkout, that's MovieGeeks, you'll get an extra 10% off your order. Get a piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.